meeting is called to order of the joint committees of the K-12 Education, Finance, and Civil Justice Committees. Our meeting tonight is at Patrick Henry High School. It's regarding the new role that we're finally recognizing in the, how mental health affects both the education system and the juvenile justice system. And while this is happening as an issue all over the state, there are special problems because of the high number of at-risk kids in Minneapolis, and Patrick Henry High School here is home to the SPAN program for Minneapolis and has a special number of students who have certain issues. And tonight, we're going to have presentations on the new research and new methods of trying to treat these issues and work with our youth. And first thing tonight, we will have, I'm going to introduce our co-chair here tonight. She chairs the K-12 Education Finance Division. And thank the, all, both committees for coming tonight. And by the way, they said I should mention that I'm not new to this school. My dad taught here for 39 years, so I'm quite familiar with it. So, Mindy.
And I'm Representative Mindy Greiling, and I am a former teacher, but not in Minneapolis. I taught in St. Paul. And I now represent Roseville, Lauderdale, St. Anthony Village, 10 minutes north of the Capitol.
Would each legislator just mention your name and where you're from?
I'm Representative Linda Slocum, and I represent East Richfield, East and Central Bloomington. I teach in Minneapolis. I teach at Field Middle School, and one of my students is right down there.
I'm Representative Robin Brown. I represent way southern Minnesota, right up at the Iowa border, so Freeborn County and part of Maurer County. I'm a teacher as well. I teach at Albert Lee High School, art and digital photography when I'm not legislating.
I'm Representative Jerry Newton, and I represent part of Coon Rapids and part of Andover. I'm not a teacher, but I did stay at the Holiday Inn.
Hi, I'm Representative Paul Anderson. I also am not a teacher. I am a farmer. I live up in west central Minnesota, about 150 miles northwest of here. My counties are Pope and parts of Stearns and Candy, Ohio counties. Thanks for having us tonight.
Good evening. My name is Representative John Ward, and thank you for having us tonight. It's our pleasure to be here. I represent District 12A, which is Crow Wing County, Brainerd, Baxter, Crosby, Ironton, Nisswa, where you all come to spend the summer. So please keep coming. I am a former teacher, educator of 34 years, educator and coach for 34 years. So thank you for the opportunity to be with you tonight.
And I'm Representative Bob Detmer. I represent District 52A, which is in the Forest Lake area. And I was a teacher for 34 years, retired in 2007. I also had wrestling coach and coached soccer and also track. And I'm part of the K-12 Education Finance Committee. Thank you for having us.
Good evening. I'm Representative Jim Davney. I represent part of South Minneapolis, former teacher and a proud parent of two Minneapolis public school students.
Thank all of you. And the next thing on the agenda is, talk louder. The next thing is we have a presentation by our new principal here at Henry, Corey Harris. I saw him just a minute ago. There he is. And each of the presenters will have to come up because it's being taped and speak there.
Good evening. There it is. All right. I don't get to stand in front of the mic very often, so didn't know how to power it on. But good evening, Representative Greiling, Representative Mullery. My name is Corey Harris, and I am the principal here at Patrick Henry High School. My charge this evening is to welcome you and to give you a few thoughts and a little bit of information about Patrick Henry. One, welcome to Patrick Henry. It's it's a building that's rich in experience. I'll describe it that way. Very clean. We're proud of our building. We're very proud of our students. We're proud of our families, and we're proud of our staff. Here at Patrick Henry, we have about 1,200 students. Our two largest demographics, race-wise, our African-American student population is about 43%. Our Asian population is about 41%. Our white student population is about 11%. And then we have about 2% Hispanic and 2% Native American. So we're a very diverse school. We're broken up into four small learning communities. We have the Creative Fine Arts Learning Community. We have the Open Small Learning Community. We have the International Baccalaureate Learning Community. And we have the Engineering Learning Community. Looking at the topic tonight, the one thing that I would say is, as I lead schools, and this is the fourth state that I've worked in, actually, as I lead schools, I am very, very passionate about this work. I come from a family of five siblings, all boys, and I am the last of those five and the only one to pursue post-secondary education. And for me, that has made all of the difference. Post-secondary was not an expectation that my parents set for me. It was not in the plans. I decided to go post-secondary my last year in high school. And I only went post-secondary because of a lady by the name of Dr. Ruth Tibbs. And Dr. Tibbs said to me, young man, you have a lot of potential. You have a lot of promise. What is your plan? And I didn't have a plan. And so she gave me a plan, and that plan was, you're going to college, and I'm going to help you get there. Once I got to that college campus, I was a straight-A student. So as I look across our building, I believe that I have tons of students who have that same potential, but just don't have that direction or have not connected with that particular adult in their life to give them that inspiration, to give them that push, to give them that direction. So as we talk about financing schools and how do we make schools better, the key is we have to connect every student with at least one caring adult, one person that they trust, one person that they believe in. And with that, we have to have a shared understanding of values, expectations. We have to give our staffs efficacy training. But the biggest thing that we're doing here at Patrick Henry that we want to expand is we want to give our teachers an opportunity to communicate and connect with each other during the school day. My philosophy is if it's worth happening, it's worth happening during the school day. And education seems to be one of those professions where teachers work in silos. The bell rings, the students come in, they close the door, they teach the kids, the bell rings, and that practice goes on and on and on. So one of the things that we're really hoping to do here at Patrick Henry and hopefully across the district is to create a 7-period day that will allow our teachers to teach 5 classes, have their personal planning period, and then also have what is called a professional learning community period. That's a period where they can connect with other teachers throughout the building, reflect on their practice, they can observe each other in each other's classrooms, get tips, discuss specific kids, and discuss specific strategies. So that is the biggest wish that I would have in terms of how to improve the level of education for our students, how to get our students better connected with their schools, with the programs that they're in, with the teachers who are teaching them. And I'll leave with this thought. The past is a dead issue. We can't gain any momentum moving toward tomorrow if we're dragging the past behind us. Again, welcome, and I look forward to what the evening holds. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Hennepin County Commissioner Gail Dorfman for an overview of tonight.
How's that?
That's much better. I think I can. Well, thank you to
to Chairs Greiling and Mullery and the members of the committee for holding this joint hearing of the K-12 and Civil Justice Committees here at Patrick Henry. Some might see this as a bit of an odd pairing of unrelated issues, almost as odd perhaps as having someone from county government testifying on K-12 issues. But we've learned a few things at the county, at Hennepin County over the years, that taking, as I would characterize it, a siloed approach just doesn't work very well for our kids. In fact, it ends up costing a lot of money without getting much in the way of positive outcomes. If we as government and as a community respond to health care issues, mental health care issues, social service issues, correctional issues, chemical dependency issues, and education issues in a vacuum, each within their own silo, then for many young people, all we're doing is perpetuating a cycle of failure. The alternative, with far better results, is to break down the silos and respond in a more integrated fashion, holistically. And that's what you're going to hear about tonight. On the ground, in the schools initiatives throughout Minneapolis and Hennepin County that are giving particularly at-risk young people a chance for not only academic success, but life success. So before I turn it over to hear from folks, let me just briefly mention some facts that I think we all know. High school dropouts are more likely to be incarcerated, unemployed, be on public assistance, and go without health insurance than people who graduate from high school. Without a high school diploma, average earnings, we know, are considerably lower, and even average life expectancy is lower, about 3 years lower for both men and women. The dropout rate for students with severe emotional and behavioral needs is approximately twice that of other students. Children who are homeless or highly mobile, children in foster care with multiple placements, and children who intersect the correction system do dismally in school. They fall behind and drop out at higher rates, more than twice as likely to drop out of high school. In the Minneapolis public school system, there are about 1,200 children identified as homeless or highly mobile on any given day. In Hennepin County, there are 2,500 kids in foster care today, and another 2,500 kids on juvenile probation. There are a total of 3,500 children who are brought to the juvenile detention center each year, and another 200 children who are placed at the county homeschool. So whether we're talking about mental health issues, homelessness, foster care, or corrections, these are all children at high risk of failure. But we know that access to mental health care reduces special education referrals, truancy, and improves the overall school climate. We know that prevention and early intervention works best, delivering, as the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group called for, the right care at the right time and in the right setting. And we know that educational success of our children is critical to the overall health of our communities and affects all aspects of our government and how we spend increasingly limited resources. And we also know that it's not good enough to implement pilot programs that show great results, but then fail to bring them to scale and sustain them. We've been doing that for way too long. So now we're going to hear tonight about what we're achieving when schools and counties and communities work together on behalf of our children, how we're bringing it to scale, and working to sustain programs for the benefit of all our kids, families, and communities. Thank you again so much for being here tonight.
Johnson from the Minneapolis Public Schools on a special new program, the Positive Behavioral Interventions and Support System. And I think we're going to try a new mic. Is that not working? No, to him.
there's a lot of reverberation from the one on the podium.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay.
See if that works a little clearer.
Yep, I think it does. People can hear? Okay. Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Director of Student Support Services for Minneapolis Schools. And I'm pleased tonight to have an opportunity to speak with you about school-wide positive behavior interventions.
I think you better pick it up. It doesn't pick up if you're not talking.
Okay, is that's better? Okay. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to speak with you tonight about school-wide positive behavior interventions and supports. Minnesota has a long history of supporting the education of our children. As a community, we understand that the success of our kids in school is critical to lay the foundation for their success in employment as parents and as citizens. And school failure is oftentimes the first step to incarceration. In order to ensure that students are successful in school, teachers need to not only employ the best of curricula and teaching strategies, but they also need to create and sustain learning environments which are safe and predictable and well-ordered. They need to create an environment that teaches the social skills which makes it possible for students to successfully live in the school community and that are able to meet the needs of specific students who have behavioral or mental health challenges. For many years, in survey after survey, teachers have told us that student behavior is one of the primary reasons that they leave the profession and one of the primary challenges that they have in classrooms. But in many situations, schools are not able to address these issues by themselves. We need the support of our community. We need the community to engage with us in working with these kids. And tonight you're going to hear about some of the efforts within Hennepin County that bring together the schools and communities as partners. Over the past decade, schools across the nation and here in Minnesota have been implementing school-wide positive behavior interventions and supports. PBIS is a research-based comprehensive design that is founded in the belief that just like reading and math, behavior must also be taught. It provides a proactive and systematic way for schools to establish durable systems of identifying behavioral expectations or norms across all school settings, consistently reinforcing those behaviors and consistently having effective interventions when students fail to meet the expectations. Simply described, as a school implements PBIS, representatives of the school community, teachers, administrators, parents, support staff, community members, come together to identify 3 to 5 goals, behavioral expectations that will exemplify the norms for that school. They then, in very specific ways, in positive terms, define how these behaviors will be exemplified in their school. They intentionally teach the behaviors to the students and find ways of systematically reinforcing and recognizing the behaviors which the students exhibit. School behavior data is regularly reviewed to identify the areas or the times of day or the places where difficulties exist, and the school, the programs are modified in order to address those concerns. Teachers in the classrooms also use the building expectations in constructing their classroom management systems. Again, differentiated by age, teaching what the expectations look like in their classroom. Research indicates that when this is implemented with fidelity, about 80% of the students respond well and are able to live by and participate in the school
environment successfully. On the graphic that you have in front of you, the base of the triangle that's there, the green area, indicates this these 80%. But it also means that about 20% of the students will need additional support, and we can anticipate that we will have to provide additional instructions and supports for them. The second level of support is designed to provide targeted interventions for students who need additional support more than what the universal systems provide. Secondary prevention, the yellow portion of the graphic, is often involves reteaching the expectations or additional practice with the behaviors. But other examples of secondary prevention include social skills group, self-management programs, or adult mentoring. With this level of support, research indicates that about an additional 15% of the kids will be able to successfully meet the school expectations and succeed in school. For the final 5%, individualized interventions are necessary. For these students, based on an individual assessment, plans are developed which result in specific sets of supports designed for the student. These plans may involve individualized reinforcement plans, intensive social skills instruction, and close collaboration with the community and with the family. Schools here in Minneapolis and across the state, with the leadership and support of the Department of Education's program for PBIS training and mentoring, have found that we are able to achieve these results. When PBIS is implemented with fidelity, and when the efforts are sustained for 3 to 5 years, we are able to meet these results that are represented in the national levels. The fidelity to this model means that all of the adults in the school need to participate in the development, in the teaching, in the reinforcing of the desired behavior. It needs to be done until this simply becomes a way that we behave and that we act in our school. But fidelity also means that we need to work to ensure that the families and the students who have additional needs have the supports that they need. And as I said in the beginning, as you will hear, no one of us can accomplish this critical role. We have found that we need the concerted efforts and the collaborative efforts of our community in order to meet the needs of our students and families. And we have found, as Commissioner Dorfman has said, in our community, a commitment to the future of the students and willing partners in developing these supports. So again, thank you for the opportunity to address you tonight. I hope that you find this information that you'll hear helpful to you in the decisions that you need to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And the next presenter is Shar Mickelbust on social emotional learning.
Good evening, Chairs Greiling and Mullery, representatives. I'm happy to be here tonight in the hallowed halls of Henry High School. I'm a proud graduate of Patrick Henry High School. Just a few short decades ago, in fact. I'm here tonight to talk about social-emotional learning. And social-emotional learning is the process by which children and adults acquire the knowledge and attributes and skills that they need to recognize and manage emotions, demonstrate caring and concern for others, establish positive relationships, make responsible decisions, and handle challenging situations constructively. We might ask why school-based SEL is needed. SEL, by the way, is the acronym. In education, we can't live without acronyms. So SEL is the acronym for social-emotional learning. There are a great deal of data indicating that large numbers of children are contending with significant social, emotional, and mental health barriers to learning. Also, many children engage in challenging behaviors in school, and they are behaviors that could be prevented with programs like positive behavior interventions and supports that Jim just talked about. and also social-emotional learning, which really is a sister or sibling to positive behavior interventions and supports. We know that social-emotional learning is evidence-based. There was a 2008 meta-analysis, a study of studies of social-emotional learning programs. There were 207 studies involving 288,000 students in the United States, and they found a broad range of benefits for all students. There was a 9% decrease in conduct problems, such as classroom misbehavior, a 10% decrease in emotional distress, such as anxiety and depression, a 9% improvement in attitudes about self, others, and school, a 23% improvement in social and emotional skills, 9% improvement in school and classroom behavior, and an 11% improvement in achievement test scores. And this is very important because often people wonder if social-emotional learning doesn't take precious time away from academics. And actually, the research indicates that involvement in these programs does not detract from academic performance and, in fact, enhances it. Social-emotional learning instruction is delivered through programs that are called SAFE programs, which means that they are determined to have sequenced activities, active forms of learning, that they're focused on social-emotional learning with at least 8 consecutive sessions devoted to specific skill development, which might be things like expressing emotions, handling a disagreement with a peer, being able to recognize that somebody else has feelings that are different from one's own, and that have explicit skills targeted for development that are identified in learning objectives. And there are about 90 programs that have been determined to meet all of these standards and that are endorsed by an organization called CASEL, which is the Collaborative for Academic and Social-Emotional Learning. The reason that SEL is so important for life success is really exemplified by some research that was performed by the U.S. Department of Labor, Employment, and Training Project, and they documented the top 7 skills that employers most look for in potential employees. And interestingly, most of them involve social-emotional learning competence. Things like learning to learn, listening and oral communication, adaptability, creative thinking and problem solving, personal management, things like having self-esteem, setting goals, being motivated, group effectiveness, having interpersonal skills, being able to negotiate and work as a member of a team, and also to have organizational effectiveness and leadership. And finally, the last skill that was identified, interestingly enough, was competence in reading, writing, and computation. So I think this illustrates that how we function emotionally is really crucial to our success in our life after school. At the national level, there are several school districts, for instance, Illinois and Alaska, that have already adopted SEL performance standards and benchmarks. There is also bipartisan legislation at the national level that has been introduced to establish a National Technical Assistance and Training Center for Social-Emotional Learning and to provide grants to support evidence-based social and emotional learning programming, and also to conduct a national evaluation of a school-based social and emotional learning program. On January 4th, this bill was referred to the Subcommittee on Early Childhood, Elementary, and Secondary Education. Many foundations that are devoted to education are also focusing on social-emotional learning. The Hahn Foundation, Goldie Hahn, is an active supporter of SEL, and George Lucas's foundation, Edutopia, is all about social-emotional learning. Additionally, Jennifer Buffett, president of the Novo Foundation, and SEL happens to be their top priority, stated when she testified before Congress, "The social and emotional learning movement is gaining momentum nationally. This is a pivotal moment. As a society, we can't just keep hoping for better academic performance from children without addressing the issues that keep them from focusing. SEL works because it emphasizes a context where children know they are seen, heard, and valued. It's fundamental and needs to be infused across the educational experience. The leadership these lawmakers have shown represents a major step toward that goal." And finally, I would just indicate that In schools, we're all about preparing people, our students, for academic success. But what we need to realize is that a student who has academic success alone and doesn't have social-emotional skills in terms of awareness of self, awareness of others, problem-solving, conflict resolution, is really like a pea floating in an ocean. The intellectual skills just get lost. There needs to be this whole other support system of social-emotional health. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next speaker will be Mark Sander on school-based mental health services. He's the mental health coordinator for Hennepin County and Minneapolis Public Schools.
Good evening, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, representatives. I'm Dr. Mark Sander. I'm a senior clinical psychologist of Hennepin County and the mental health coordinator for Hennepin County and the Minneapolis Public Schools. I want to thank the committee for giving me an opportunity to share some information about school mental health. As a number of people have mentioned tonight, school success and positive mental health are critical for success in life. The dropout rate of students with severe emotional and behavioral needs are approximately twice that of other students. And when students drop out, they're at higher risk for criminal justice, economic assistance, and social service system involvement. Mental health and school success are closely related, as untreated mental health issues are significant barriers to learning, resulting in poor school performance and school failure. 1 in 5 children have a diagnosable mental health disorder, yet 70 to 80% of them do not receive treatment or receive inadequate treatment. The need to improve access for mental health services is urgent. Schools provide significantly improved access for families and students. In addition, schools are an ideal place for mental health promotion, prevention, and early intervention services, such as PBIS and social emotional learning. And when students have a more serious mental health problem, research has shown that having a licensed mental health provider on site at the school can dramatically increase the student's access to and participation in the needed mental health services. Nationally, the school mental health movement has been growing for the last 15 years. These programs provide mental health services integrated into the schools and have been shown to improve access to services for children and families, especially those that may be hard to reach through traditional community-based services. In Minneapolis and Hennepin County, we've been implementing these types of school mental health programs for the past several years. Beginning with the Safe Schools, Healthy Students grant in 2003, the Minneapolis School Mental Health Program was developed through a partnership between the Minneapolis Public Schools, Hennepin County, and several community mental health agencies. In Minneapolis, the School Mental Health Program integrates a broad continuum of mental health services and supports into the schools by locating a mental health professional on site, and then partnering with the student support staff already there in the schools. These programs augment and build upon the services already being provided by the student support staff in schools. Through a contractual relationship with the county and each school district, a mental health agency places a licensed mental health professional at the school, and it's usually equivalent to a full-time position, but that can vary depending on the size of the school. These professionals provide a range of services on site, including prevention and early intervention services, including teacher consultation and training, through diagnostic evaluation and therapy. They work closely with school personnel, including principals, teachers, school social workers, school psychologists, school nurses, and school counselors. These services are available to both general ed and special education students. Over the last few years, school mental health programs have been expanding across Hennepin County. First through a grant through the Children's Mental Health Collaborative of Hennepin County, and then the Governor's Mental Health Initiative created significant grant funds allocated to the Minnesota Department of Human Services, which enabled school mental health to further expand across Hennepin County and the state of Minnesota. These grant funds, especially the DHS grant program, has been critical to the expansion of school mental health in Minnesota. Currently, there are 21 grantees serving 54 counties, 200 school districts, and 548 schools through the DHS grant funds. In Hennepin County, the Hennepin County School Mental Health Initiative is a collaboration between 13 school districts, 69 schools, and 10 community mental health agencies in Hennepin County Human Service and Public Health Department that has made mental health services and supports available to 63,000 students across Hennepin County. This year, it's estimated that about 2,000 students and their families will receive assessment and treatment services from the program. School mental health programs are designed to provide both mental health services and supports. Many of these services are funded through health insurance reimbursement, but some are not. The financial model we're using in Minneapolis maximizes the third-party reimbursement for treatment through families' health insurance. We have found that we can capture up to two-thirds of the cost of the program through health insurance reimbursement and the county funding the uninsured, leaving about one-third of the funding needed from grants and other funding sources. The partners are developing a collaborative financing and long-term sustainability strategies that braid health insurance reimbursement, county, state, and school district financial support to create a strong financial base for the program. So what about the outcomes? Data from the last several years from the Minneapolis sites have shown that 85% of the students were seen at least once by a mental health professional, and 65% of the students had never received mental health services before. In addition, the program has shown that students are receiving an appropriate amount of treatment, averaging 15 face-to-face visits in a school year. The reason why this is important is that research on evidence-based treatments have been shown that indicate that about 10 to 15 treatment sessions are needed for those interventions to be effective. The program has also helped students improve their mental health and educational outcomes. Both teachers and parents report improvements in students' mental health. Program data has identified a decrease in school suspensions. Additionally, principals have reported a belief that the program has significantly reduced office referrals and student suspensions. Increasing the capacity of teachers and school staff to work effectively with students with mental health concerns is a key goal of the program. About 20 to 30% of the mental health clinicians' activities are spent providing consultation to school staff, classroom presentations on mental health topics, and mental health trainings to school staff. In closing, school mental health programs increase access and help sustain engagement in mental health treatment, which are critical to improving the outcomes for children and families, especially for families who in the past have had difficulty accessing community-based services. School mental health programs, when done well, are based on strong partnerships, provide us the opportunity to leverage the expertise and resources of several major systems that touch children's lives to help achieve the best possible outcome for our children. This important work can only be sustained through the strong, effective partnerships that at their core have a shared vision for school mental health, school districts, mental health providers, and health plans, county and state governments all have a role. No one organization or system can do it on their own. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. And next we have Julie Harris from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office explaining their new approach on reducing and addressing truancy issues.
Representative Greiling, Representative Mullery, representatives. Thank you for the opportunity to tell you about an exciting collaboration between the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, county departments, Hennepin County schools, and community agencies to prevent educational neglect and truancy. This is a new program called Be at School. We all know how important education is to the success of all children and to our communities as a whole. Yet because of economic pressures, Hennepin County is struggling to continue to support the educational programs that it has historically provided and that are needed to ensure that meaningful educational opportunities are available to all of its children. Despite the financial challenges, the leadership in Hennepin County has recently taken steps to make it more likely that its children will have the education necessary to realize their potential. First, the Hennepin County Board passed a resolution that all students in Hennepin County will graduate from high school. Next, they formed AGRAD. It's a committee, stands for Accelerating Graduation by Reducing Achievement Disparities, to implement their resolution. One of AGRAD's first efforts was to sponsor the development of a new strategy to address the problems of truancy and educational neglect. They did this because they recognized that consistent school attendance is necessary for educational achievement. You've heard reference by other speakers tonight about the consequences of not succeeding in school, and you're going to hear it once more from me because I think these are so important to really understand. Research tells us that high absenteeism is linked to poor standardized test scores, poor academic performance, poor self-esteem, dropping out of high school, teen pregnancy, juvenile and adult crime, underemployment, and unemployment. I don't think we can overstress the importance of consistent school attendance and achievement. County Attorney Mike Freeman agreed to lead the county's effort to prevent school truancy. He did this because he has a long-standing, deep commitment to preventing crime and improving the lives of children. In addition, he had already piloted a new approach to educational neglect called Education for Success in 7 Minneapolis elementary schools. That was shown to significantly improve school attendance. So working with AGRAD, county administration, county departments, juvenile court, community agencies, and the schools, Be At School was developed. Born of a collaboration, Be At School is itself a collaborative educational model. Schools are encouraged to maximize their connections and efforts with families and students early on. Ultimately, those connections are essential to consistent attendance and achievement. After the school has made efforts to stop student absences, but still early on, families are referred to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Our office engages parents first in a group setting to personally encourage school attendance, provide information about the consequences of not going to school, which are both legal and social, and offer assistance to those who are interested in assistance at that time. If absences continue beyond the legal limit, schools will report to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, which will notify child protection in educational neglect cases. We will then meet individually with parents along with a community agency or child protection and a school representative to identify the barriers that are preventing school attendance. Families will be directly connected to a community agency with whom our office has contracted or has a relationship with. The community agency will work with the family and the child to get the student to school. They may provide other services or refer for other services, but the focus will be very specific, breaking down the barriers to school attendance. Attendance will be tracked closely. If absences continue and we have no other options, a child protection or truancy petition will be filed with juvenile court. But this process is not about filing cases in court quickly. That is not our goal. Research and our experience shows that court has limited effectiveness, and we are not about doing things that aren't effective. We are also developing creative alternative strategies, including using the resources of our great library system to make court orders to attend school more likely to be successful. As you can see, Be At School is an ambitious collaboration that requires commitment, creativity, community, and compassion. We think that this collaboration can have a substantial impact on school attendance, which will improve school achievement and unlock the door to the opportunities that our community has to offer. We hope that you will support our efforts in any way possible. Thank you.
Thank you. And next is Sally Reynolds on creating school success for students in the juvenile justice system. She's director of the Success Academy for the Minneapolis Public Schools.
Representative Greiling, Representative Mullery, and fellow representatives. My name is Sally Reynolds, and I'm the director of Success Academy at Minneapolis Public Schools. I've been honored to work with pretty much everyone that has spoken this evening. Through collaborations with Hennepin County, community agencies, and Minneapolis Public Schools in addressing the needs of students who are involved in the criminal justice system, who have mental health issues, chemical health issues, and other life circumstances that are hampering their educational success. Success Academy was developed by Hennepin County Department of Corrections and Social Services and Minneapolis Public Schools to address students who had high levels of truancy and subsequently community involvement were on probation. The focus of the program was to increase communication amongst our systems, as that tended to be a fairly significant impediment to students being able to run around the systems and say, well, my PO said this, my principal says this, my teacher says this, my community worker says this. So increasing that communication by placing someone from the Department of Corrections in the school who worked with the POs, who communicated with the teachers, who communicated with the principal to make sure that we knew students' addresses. So when they were summoned to court, we knew exactly where they lived and that they got the notice. And we reminded them and reminded them, which reduced the number of warrants that were issued because students didn't show up to court. We also increased outreach efforts. So we have Volunteers of America are contracted with by Hennepin County to come in, go to people's homes, call families, call any relative who is on an emergency card, to go to parents' jobs if necessary to say, why is this kid not in school? Why aren't they here? And then also adding co-located supports because parents typically are working a great deal or they are just uninvolved and have their own issues, and so asking them to go and make a mental health appointment, maybe two, maybe three, just to get services initiated for that student is unreasonable. So we locate chemical health supports in the school. We locate mental health supports in the school. We have community people come in and work with students and families in the school so that there's not a whole lot of I can't get there. You know, transportation is typically a significant issue. And these supports are in place to increase attendance and increase participation. If a student can't get there or doesn't stay all day, they're not going to be able to earn the credit. They're not going to be able to graduate. If they come and do no work, because a lot of students will come and sleep through the entire class, if they're not participating, they're still not going to earn the credit. So it's creating small class sizes. It's having, again, the VOA's support, behavior support staff, to pull that student out, process with them, and get them back into class. So there's not hours and hours of processing. What do you need to work on? Let's get you back into class and back focused on your academics. And because of the increased communication and the co-located services, there's no mystery as to what's going on with the student or what it is that student needs as their plans developed to say, okay, they're upset today, we're going to pull them out, and then we're going to get them back into class because we all know what the plan is. So the increased communication, the increased outreach, and the presence of the co-located services has really shown to be a benefit to students getting off of probation, being able to stay in school. We've had students who haven't been in school for 2 years, and they've been in school with us for 2 years in the same school. Students who had been in 8 different schools in their Minneapolis career have been in the same school for 2 years, which is huge when you're dealing with kids who have typically gone to school, not felt safe, not felt comfortable, and not felt accepted. So those are things that we strive in a small setting with these co-located services. I believe that we're making progress. We're still collecting our data, but we see small anecdotal success. Thank you.
Thank you, and I know I'm very active with the juvenile justice. Oh, just a second. Do you want her to come back? Do you want her to come back to answer a question?
I was wondering if we were going to be able to address before the students engage, before we engage the students, if we were going to be able to address any of the speakers.
Our understanding was that as soon as we finished the next one, we would have questions from.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There, and then one of the state agencies asked to speak, the Asian Pacific, because there's a lot of students at this school that are Asian Pacific. And I was just going to say that with the National Conference of State Legislatures, they're finding recent studies show that as much as 70% of the students in the juvenile justice system have mental health issues, and we are treating apparently less than 10%. So this is one of the huge problems. Next speaker is from the Silver Ribbon Campaign at South High School on reducing stigma and educating youth about mental illness. And you'll
Chair
have to
state
your name because we don't have it.
Chair Skryling and Mullery. I am Chloe Cardinal. I'm a junior at South High School and a leader of Silver Ribbon Campaign. Our group meets every other Wednesday for an hour, and we discuss a variety of mental illnesses, including how to identify them, when and why they occur, and how to treat them, among other things. We strongly believe that a more informative mental health curriculum needs to be put into place in all public middle schools and high schools to better inform the students and staff about the effects of mental illness. Mental illness affects every single person, whether they have it themselves or know someone else who does. Many mental illnesses develop in adolescence, starting to show as early as middle school and developing further throughout high school. To educate the students about mental illness is to encourage sensitivity among classmates, help teachers understand difficulties students are having, and to encourage students to form a better vocabulary to discuss mental illness among friends and families. Other than educating students about different mental illnesses, the Silver Ribbon Campaign at South High School aims to ease our community of the stigma surrounding mental illness. The main reason why people don't get help throughout middle and high school when dealing with mental illnesses they have or friends who are having issues is due to lack of knowledge on the subject. Oftentimes, students don't realize they have a mental illness and that they could be getting treated for it. A fellow leader of the Silver Ribbon Campaign, my friend Molly, says that learning in health class, we should learn that depression and anxiety are just as big of an issue as learning how to put on a condom and that it should be included in our curriculum. Difficulties of having mental illness include poor grades, isolation, and confusion. These aspects of mental illness are hard to deal with, especially in young adults. By introducing a more useful curriculum in the health classes in schools, we may be able to provide the resources necessary for students to find the help they need. This would include required health classes in middle school that educate the students about identifying mental illnesses, how to get help for themselves or someone who needs help, and learning about medication, therapy, and other forms of treatment for mental illnesses. I find that a lot of students in my high school learn about the health program, and even just gym, but health in general in their 11th and 12th grade years. And I think that they need to be educated much earlier, especially concerning mental illness by 7th or 8th grade. At South, our Silver Ribbon Campaign started 6 years ago with about 7 students who wanted to learn more about mental illness. In the last 6 years, our group has grown to about 80 students per meeting. We bring in speakers at our meetings. Some are former students who want to share their stories. Others are professionals who are able to inform us of the whens, whats, hows, and whys of the mental illnesses we are discussing that day. Our students ask questions or share stories of their own. Over the past 3 years I have been a part of Silver Ribbon Campaign, Some of our most informative and most attended meetings were discussing depression, Tourette's, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, cause of suicide, eating disorders, drug addiction, and examining the brain. One of the main reasons South's Silver Ribbon Campaign is successful in educating so many students about mental illness is that we are a student-led group. We are all there because we choose to be. So, if a group of students as large as ours and constantly growing wants to learn about mental illness, there must be other students at other schools who want to learn as well but don't know where or how to. If we are able to provide resources to students who need help, Silver Ribbon Campaign believes that it's worth implementing a new educational system into our schools. We would like mental illness to be an open topic rather than a taboo. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And could all the speakers come up for questions? And then while they're coming up, David Zander, is he still here? He requested to... can all of the rest of the speakers come up? There's open chairs up here, and I think the legislators and possibly the audience even will have questions of them. And David, if you came up to while they're coming up, and if you can limit it to a few minutes so that we can get all the questions in. Yes, David, yeah. Ms. Cardinal, could you come up also? Or, there. And then, David, you can just start while they're getting organized here. And, David is from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, which is a state agency. Asked to make a short statement.
Representative Grayling and Representative Mullery, legislators, State Council on Asian Pacific. I've been in the job about 15 years, and we have seen a decline in services. So I want to throw out two things tonight. One will be the role of nonprofits. In this school, in the fall of 2008, we did a focus group here. And we also did one at North High with the Check and Connect program. So we have a report on dropout prevention. The thing that really stands out for me from that report is how much a support the students were to each other in the Asian clubs. What we saw when we asked the students for their views about dropout prevention, they were resisting parents who said, "Don't go to college." They were resisting siblings who said, "Leave school, drop out, join gangs." So the Asian clubs themselves were incredible support. We've also seen a decline in services. Don Calderboy was here, wonderful resource for the Hmong students. We saw them get stretched thinner and thinner, not just in one school, but then having to serve 2, 3, 4 schools. Positions eliminated, so that has been a very sad factor. When Ventura came into office, my phone started ringing off the hook with his first budget. In his line item veto, he had slashed all the funding to the Southeast Asian juvenile prevention programs. And I'll get to mental health in a minute. But we had a number of programs. For example, Vietnamese social services. There were staff who could go into the schools, reach the Vietnamese kids, and help them with any kind of conflicts they had, whether it was with each other, peer-peer, conflict with teachers, conflict with parents. So with one slash of a veto, that funding was eliminated. It had stood there many, many years. Association for the Advancement of Hmong Women, United Cambodian Association, Southeast Asian Community Council. That small nonprofit is about 3 blocks from here. And you'll find tonight students there being helped, mentored, helped with their homework. I've also seen the students helping each other, like the second, third generation Hmong students helping the newcomers. So I want to really put nonprofits back on the program for funding. I think they're a valuable resource. Refugees are still arriving. We have the Karen students coming, and we have students from Bhutan. If you Google the other face of Bhutan, you will find what I wrote about the Bhutanese that are here. Now, I'll finish with a little story. When I was a graduate student, CURA had a program where we could go out and help on projects. And I happened to see an opportunity go to the Limited English Proficiency Program in the Minneapolis schools. This was around about 1981. And I was helping evaluating that program. There was one Hmong teacher that wasn't doing very well in the third grade class. And they had all this curriculum, science and math and English. And I had been a teacher. I had been a teacher in Kenya, been in a teacher in London, and was in the anthropology education program. So I said to him, well, let's take a unit, because it seemed to be the problem he was having was lesson planning. And we took a unit on technology. And I said, well, let's do a collage, get the kids to draw what they remember of technology. There was a quiet, and two Hmong girls went up to the board, and they drew the Mekong River. They drew soldiers firing at them from both sides of the river, from Thailand and from Laos. They drew grandmothers drowning in the river. They drew the refugee camp with huge guards going around. And my thought was, my goodness, we are talking about getting these kids into English and science and math, but nobody is looking at the trauma that these kids have been through and helping them. So I think when we heard social economic, social emotional learning, you know, it was needed and it hadn't been done. They were still having traumatized refugees coming. So we need to screen these kids. We really need to help them. And I think the nonprofits are one of the places where they most get help after school in their communities. Thank you.
Thank you, David. David, you didn't know it, but you just invited yourself to submit to questions, and the co-chair tonight has one for you. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Ward is first, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments and then a question. Ms. Cardinal, is it amazing when we empower youth what they do? I mean, you and your fellow students are a prime example of when we empower you, you can do and you have done and will continue to do remarkable things. My challenge to you and your group is to expand out into other schools and other children and make sure that they have learned what you have learned and have that opportunity as well. So please continue with what you do. And to all the presenters, you are remarkable in what you are doing for our youth and making and caring and giving. And so thank you for that. I have a question for Ms. Julie Harris. I think this is Julie, right? Where's Ms. Julie Harris? There, okay. And I was reading through your Be At School. I love that Be At School. I was an emotionally behavior disorder teacher, learning disabled teacher, and then I ran an alternative education program. So, you know, I too worked with at-risk and difficult young people, children that had mental health issues as well. I have a question about the STAR referral and child protection report. You know, when it gets to the point where you call a, what's it called, the STAR meeting? I think it's called the STAR meeting. I see that you call in the parent, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, the school liaison, and the contracted community agent child or their child protection worker, but not the child. Why? Tell me. Can you tell me why? And then I have another question beyond that, if I might, Mr. Chair. Why don't you call the child then to that meeting?
Is this on?
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Ward. We actually do call the student in when they're older. the 12 students and up. We bring them into the STAR meeting. They're invited to it, and we think that they can meaningfully participate. For students who are under 12, the law places the responsibility for school attendance on the parent. And so our emphasis there is on the parent. And so that's why we don't invite the child into the when they're under 12.
Thank you for that, and I'm glad to hear that the older kids are definitely invited to that as well. And then my last question to you, and these are all remarkable programs that are really looking like they're making a difference in Hennepin County for sure. I noticed that a student can get up to a total of 17 unexcused absences, and in that process, there's interventions all throughout the process. Having been an EBD teacher, an LD teacher, alternative education director, sometimes it's not unexcused absences that cause a problem, it's even excused absences. And so is there anything, I mean, have you thought about that as, you know, as far as, is there anything including like a total number of absences or sometimes the kids get their parents to call in for me, mom, or call in for me, dad, and, you know, that kind of a scenario. So could you address that too?
Yes, we recognize that. And actually, the information that comes to us on the referrals and the reports includes not just unexcused absences, but excused absences also. So we can get a more complete picture of what the absences look like. But our goal in using the community agencies is that they're going to keep tabs on attendance, and that means both unexcused and excused absences, looking for those kinds of excuses that that are problematic. So it's not that we're ignoring them. The law speaks of unexcused absences, so that's where our emphasis is. But obviously, we intend to take a more holistic look at what's going on with the family.
Great. Thank you for allowing me to go back to my EBD and alternative world again for a minute.
Thank you.
All right. I too want to thank the speakers and the audience for their interest in mental health and how the education system and the juvenile justice system overlap. And it's very helpful for me to be here and actually hear some of the practitioners that are working on some of the things we've had bills on in the legislature, but we don't get to hear how it's playing out in the field, such as the positive behavior intervention and things like that. And I hope that I'll give a even though Sue Abderholden is in the audience, the executive director of NAMI Minnesota, and I know we were going to thank her at the end, but I'll thank her now too. But I would ask her at some point, I would like some information, being we have legislators from all around the state, you know, how typical is Hennepin County? I have a feeling they're a really good actor and that we don't have as good of mental health services in all areas of the state. But this is certainly an exemplary group of speakers and opportunities for students in this district that we've heard tonight. My question, though, is for Mr. Zander, and so I'm glad you volunteered to testify, so you're stuck here at the table with us. And since you're representing the Southeast Asians, I know that one of the underlying issues with mental illness, in addition just to plain being a hard illness to tell, is it behavior, is it sickness, and so forth, is people's reticence to talk about it. And we've come a long ways through the help of students like Ms. Cardinal from the Silver Ribbon Campaign, and I think young people today are much more open. But I have remember reading The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down about the Hmong culture, and that was epilepsy. But we've had testimony at the legislature in the past that the Hmong community does not even have a word for mental illness because it's such a taboo topic. And I'm wondering if you can give us, I can see that the students don't receive the services in proportion to their numbers, but I'm wondering, is there any progress being made in the Asian communities to acknowledge mental illness, talk about it, and that's related to coming forward and asking for services?
Representative Grayling, thank you for the question. When the first tragedies happened in the Hmong community, the Hmong leaders very quickly formed the Hmong Mental Health Providers Network. And I gave written testimony here from Tony Tong Yang at the Wilder, used to be the Wilder Southeast Asian Social Adjustment Program, which is where this group regularly met for many years. And these questions came up very early. I remember about 8 years ago, Kathy Shugman, a licensed psychologist, saying, could we have a directory? Can we just simply have a directory? Like, what is the Hmong for autism? What is the Hmong for mental health? And no, we discovered very quickly from the Hmong professionals, no, we could not have a directory. That metaphor, stories, looking at every situation in context was what was needed. I remember one of the doctors saying a patient would come in and say, the spirit shook my foot all night, or I have lost my soul. So I think the short answer is there is a Hmong mental health providers network. Young Hmong have been going through college. We helped Hmong with the barriers of getting their social work license, which was often due just to coming here late in life and struggling with multiple choice tests and struggling with the license. But they are in place. Tony Tong Yang said, it is hard to get the young Hmong to come into the social service professions. But they are the bridge builders. They are the ones who can work with the families that believe in shamans or, and you're right, no, there is no word for mental health, but they have other ways of getting through that. There is a new group now formed that is the Refugee Mental Health Group, meets at the Minnesota Council of Churches once a month, Sue Johnson. And I see there's a group that are really struggling to go forward and really deal with the kind of issues behind your question.
Sue, after Holden, you're being summoned to come up also. Sue put this together, and I don't think she realized she was going to be on the hot seat, too. And, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. Couple questions. One for Dr. Sander. Did I understand correctly that you have 10 to 15 interventions per student for when you think that there's some mental problem with the student?
Sure. Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, Representative Newton. So what I was talking about there was, you know, typically in mental health services, a student will, a family will come in and a student will receive treatment. And what I was talking about for the number of intervention was the number of sessions that a student had on average. So a student that was seen by a mental health clinician in the school, on average in a school year, it was 10 to 15 about 15 face-to-face visits in the school year. There was a whole range for the group of students that received services, but the average was 15.
And may I ask, Doctor, about how many students out of the population of 1,400 would that encompass?
So in Minneapolis, in the Minneapolis public schools, we have, we started in five schools, and I think we served about 300 students, and as a program that have been served has grown. But typically in a school, the clinician will see about 45 to 50 students in a school year. For treatment services, they might be referred more.
Thank you. If I could just follow up, coming from, I was on the school board in Okehannabun, and this year alone, so far this year, we've had three suicides among students. And in addition to the cultural differences and the so-called subgroups, we have the cross-cultural group of GBLT students. Many of whom are having troubles adjusting in school and may have mental health problems. Are they being addressed as well, separately? Is it all, you know, one group that's being addressed when you come to that?
So the way that the program is set up in the school is that it really works through the school social worker and the student support staff. So teachers can come to them and talk about students that they're concerned about. then the school social worker will reach out to the family, let the family know about the availability of services on site at the school and also maybe services in the community. So it's not, it's open to all students, both in general ed and special ed. And we really strive to have, if there's a large Latino population at the school, to have a Latino provider there at the school to kind of work with those cultural groups as well. So it's available to all students. Okay.
And if I can just have one more, I guess kind of a comment. We tried working with students that were having problems, GBLT students, students with depression, and meeting with the students, they said in our district they didn't know who they could go to. They didn't know if they went to a counselor or to a teacher, if the parent would be contacted, if, you know, they would get help in the school or they'd not get help in the school, or if there would be, you know, the word would be passed around that they have an issue of some sort. How do you handle that? How do students in the Minneapolis schools know who they can go to and have someone that they consider safe in the school?
Sure. Representative Newton, I think in the 15 schools that we have the school mental health program in, there's the mental health clinician who's there, but also school social workers, school counselors, school nurses, school psychologists. So, and we make sure that students know, and that's why they do the classroom presentations as a clinician. So you get up there and you show that, you know, you're not a scary person, you're a friendly person. And then in the other schools, you've got the great student support staff that are there to help students as well. So I think it's just really making sure that those services are available at all the schools. And again, you know, when you get into will a parent know or not, the way that we have our services set up is that there is parent permission that is needed to access our mental health services from the clinicians. Accessing a school staff person is a little bit different. Now, I think that at a certain level, that person is going to want to contact the family if there's concerns, but they could have a little bit more private conversation. And then I guess the other question that you had was about confidentiality. And in all of the schools, we work very hard to keep the student feeling very comfortable knowing that, you know, all of their conversations are confidential with the therapist. They're not going to tell anybody unless they've got a release to talk with the teacher. And then when they talk with the teacher, it's just about what things are working, what are strategies that are working, those kind of things.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before we have any more questions, we have a representative that's just joined us at another meeting. First, can you introduce yourself and your area?
Good evening, everybody. Thanks for being here. My name is Gail Kulik-Jackson. I represent District 16A. It's a bit north of here in Mille Lacs, Benton, Morrison, and Sherburne counties.
Thank you. Sue, you're up here now, so you have to answer Mindy's question. How typical is Hennepin County services across services across the state?
Chairs Greiling and Mullery, Sue Aberholden from Nami, Minnesota. We actually have pockets of excellence across the state, so it isn't just in the metro area. We have some wonderful collaboration just off the top of my head in Crookston, northwestern Minnesota, where they really have tried to pull everyone together and work hard on that. In the St. Cloud area, they have collaborative dollars and used to have actually a traveling mental health school bus so that they could get to all the schools. I know in Crow Wing, the mental health center there has worked very strongly with the schools. I know I'm going to miss some of your counties here, but I do think that we do have some really good areas. Now, in a county like Hennepin, we're able to pull all these different things together. That, I think, is a little bit unusual, but sometimes, like in the Crookston area, everybody knows each other, and that makes it kind of easy to pull everybody together as well. So we do have some pockets of excellence, but I will say it is not uniform across the state, and that's where our concern comes in. I think when you look on the sheet I had handed out to you, you know, we had 5 children in 2008 that died by suicide between the ages of 5 to 14, and 85 between 15 and 24. You know, everyone gets worried about the H1N1 virus, and, you know, we need to look at these numbers. And so we know that we need to be intervening earlier with kids who have mental illness. LGBT youth are much higher, you know, suicide rate, because they already are not feeling accepted. They're often victims of bullying, which is why the anti-bullying bill is important, too, so they don't feel that life is so hopeless and they take their own life. So I think the school-based mental health is really a good push in. It helps with the data practices, so you're not kind of bleeding that information across everyone. And I think, you know, getting some groundwork done with kids who are in the juvenile justice system so that they're really supported in the schools and helped to really succeed is really critical as well.
One thing, I know you mentioned St. Cloud, they're also very good on reentry for both adults and juveniles, is my understanding. They're something we all have, including Hennepin, has to look at. Representative Ward.
May I ask Ms. Aberholden, who does a remarkable job with all mental health issues. She's the queen of mental health issues right there. She's and respected also. Were you familiar with the Silver Ribbon campaign, or are there other student? I'm really into the student group tonight that I think is so powerful and can be so helpful to all of the kind of agencies that are trying to help. So had you heard of that group, and what else is going on with our kids around the state?
Chair Skarling and Mullery, Representative Ward, actually NAMI worked with South High to get that going. As it turned out, the social worker who really got it going, Eva Newbeck, is in the audience, and we knew each other through another life. Once in a while, I have another life. And so we talked a Suzuki Saturday morning, and just, you know, she talked about the need for students who you know, had siblings or had a close friend who died by suicide or had a mother, and said, you know, we need to do something. So we collaborated and got something going. We tried actually to replicate it at two other schools, high schools, and it didn't really take off. And I think partly because you need to have someone in the school who's really strongly behind it, and Eva really was, which really helped us get it going. But we continue to collaborate on it, and if we have another school where they have someone who's really, you know, willing to be a champion within it, we'll do it. And of course, it's free. We just do it.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I have a question for the young lady sitting next to me, Mrs. Michael Buss. How, in the CEL program, the staff, how are they engaged, and do they have any additional training that they go through, and how are they engaged in the CEL program?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and Representative Detmer, the way that we do it in my district, which is Intermediate District 287, we're the Crescent District of the southern and western suburbs around Minneapolis. We have three socially emotional learning coordinators in our district who train our educational staff on evidence-based programs and interventions, and then people who are trained go out and train others, and so it's sort of a sharing with your colleagues, growing kind of endeavor. And then we have our professional learning communities focusing on socially emotional learning, and we devote our Safe Schools dollars to socially emotional learning programs.
But I am a parent as an African American.
very much. Why don't we have the doctor come up if you would want to join us? And I would just say thank you very much for your input. You know, we really miss Representative Neva Walker, who used to chair the Mental Health Caucus. I sat on it, and perhaps some other people up here did as well. And, you know, we've had a lot of African-American testifiers, and it is a omission with who we've had testify tonight. So let's rectify it right now. And you know, in the legislature, we are almost all white people, and that's a problem too. So we should overcompensate for that with our testifiers. So thank you very much. And we are going to close with you, but we do have, he's going to give you all his time, the last legislator, with a question. We are catching a bus in about 12 minutes, but you can have any of those 12 that you want. And welcome, and please give us your name.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Bravada Garrett Akinsanya, and I'm a licensed clinical psychologist at School Psychologist. And I've been working for about 30 years. I'm the executive director of the African American Child Wellness Institute, which is dedicated to the promotion of culturally competent services for children of African descent. What I hear tonight and what I understand, is it too loud? Because I'm from the country, I can be loud. Okay. It's the light. Okay. I'm in the light. And what I understand from my studies of suicide in youth, because I work with the Yellow Ribbon Campaign, I've worked with the state in looking at the student survey, which y'all are all familiar with, the Minnesota student survey that is given to 6th, 9th, and 12th grade students. And what nobody really said today is how, when you disaggregate the data, the trajectory for children of color is much worse than other populations. In Minnesota, the highest group that falls prey to mental illness, school kicking out, problems at home, or biracial youth, followed by Native American children, Latinos, and African American. Nobody at the panel has that information, because one of the reasons you can't talk about it is because we're not holding our head in a cultural place. What that means is, when you think about the, for example, my brother here talking about Minneapolis Public Schools mental health, I'm thinking about how people of color, we don't think in terms of mental illness and mental health. We think in terms of wellness. So that's what we talk about, in their various degrees of wellness, in your mind, your body, and your spirit. But if you don't come from that cultural place, you can't communicate accurately to people who are cross-cultural. The reason we have trouble with GLBT youth is because we don't have GLBT faculty and providers helping parents. Just like the young girl, I'm so proud of her, was talking about empowerment of students. Every population that has a need can come with their own voice to dictate their road to healing. And what's not happening are the people, when I hear things like juvenile justice, when I hear things like academic disparities, when I hear things like suspension rates, when I hear things like mental illness, especially ADHD, and I consult with WEMAP and a lot of the suburban schools in Minnesota, I go out there, and in special ed room, they may have 200 kids in the school, but all 30 of the black kids are going to be in special ed. And I asked one time, why is this happening? Because I know, as a clinical psychologist, the DSM tells us there's no disproportionate number of prevalence of ADHD in black youth. It tells us that's the book we use to diagnose people. But in our culture, if you speak out of turn, which we do that at church, we say amen when people are talking. We're not Norwegian. So when that happens, that's a diagnostic criteria, and they get a referral. There's so much yet to learn about what the eyes see when we see mental illness, what the helping behaviors are, who gets selected to be given a second or third or fourth or fifth time. There's research behind all of this racial disparity information. And one of the things we have to do is, I would like everybody who talks about their program to come back again with disaggregated data and let me know, as a black member of the community. How well is your program working for my kids? How well? Because if you have five apples, which are the black kids, and 95 oranges, and you squeeze them all together, that's going to be orange juice. So you're going to miss the apples. And that's what I think has been happening up here tonight. So I want to see some disaggregated data based on ethnicity, based on socioeconomic status. We do it with us. We do it with gender, because that's easy to talk about. But we don't talk about it, because if we talk about disparities on racial or ethnic lines, that means we have to talk about racism, which we're afraid to do here. And so I wanted to bring that up, and I want you to think about the data and have more accountability in your reporting to the community when you come back. It could be that it's great for black kids, or it could be that one of the things that happens is that in that environment, the things that are asked are things that you're looking for, and the client doesn't really feel they're that great. So sometimes our criteria for measuring isn't community-based. And if the community-based data isn't integrated, then you can't really say you're doing good, because you just think you're doing good according to your criteria. So the criteria may have to be community-based. And I finally want to say how many parents are being involved in these school systems. I have a wonderful program called Project Marua, Premeditated Parenting Boot Camp. And the parents come and they run the program. They are learning about every aspect of wellness, social wellness, economic wellness, education, and academic wellness. And those parents come volunteering 3 hours a week for 10 weeks in a row, volunteering to come. Nobody forces them, because they are committed to their kids. So I really want to say that whatever the data is, I would like to look at it with a critical eye. And I think it should deserve to have the scrutiny and respect of the various communities. And it should be community driven. And I think that if they get funded, every program needs to have some space to deal with cultural diversity. And they need to have a line that explains how they're going to deal culturally with the different groups that they're trying to serve. Because that's just Minnesota, and that's just respect. Thank you.
Valid question, and we have had when we had the mental health division that Representative Walker chaired, we did talk about cultural competency in the mental health system and so forth. So maybe at a later time, the information for the Minneapolis schools, you know, to see if they do have disaggregated data would be very useful for the committee to know, because that is a very important issue, and there are so many barriers for people getting mental health services, and that is certainly one of them.
I think it wouldn't be just the Minneapolis schools. I think St. Paul, Brooklyn, Park, Brooklyn Center, several schools around the we need, and it's not just for African American, it's for everyone. We need that kind of disaggregated data. Unfortunately, we are just, we don't have any time for even my question. Mindy just ruled that out. So, because we have to, most of them have to get on the bus. First, I want to thank Sue Abderholden. She's the one that set up all of the presentation for tonight. And I also wanted to, I think all of us should thank the legislative members. We worked we had session until 10 o'clock last night. Most of us had committee at 8:30 this morning, again tomorrow morning. So I think we really, everybody should thank the legislators that came tonight. And, of course, most important is the audience, because we need you to carry out this message and put it forth, talk to your legislators, and also work on this issue. And the last thing I want to thank is, I don't want to give her a big head, but I want to thank the co-chair tonight, Mindy Greiling. She's not just a leader on education, everybody knows that, and she's got a bill that's being called the Second Minnesota Miracle on Education Funding, but what not everybody knows is that she is the one who got the state legislature talking about mental health. And if you have never dealt with Mindy, you'll know that, you know, some people you call a thorn in your side if you don't do what they want. I always describe Mindy as a branding iron in your side if you're not doing what she wants. With that, thanks everyone in the